Hello, and welcome to the May IASB Update Podcast. I am Neely Shaw, the Executive Technical Director at the IASB, and today I'm joined by the Chair of the IASB, Andreas Barco. Welcome, Andreas.
Morning, Neely.
Good morning. Linda Mizan-Hutter, our Vice Chair, normally joins us, but unfortunately she's unable to this month because she is participating in a panel discussion on connectivity in Finland today. So very, very exciting topic and one that's relevant for all of us these days. So let's go ahead and get started. This month, the IASB had two meetings, and we'll provide you with highlights from both of them. We'll start with our supplementary meeting that we had in early May, where we considered the first ever urgent amendment to the IFRS for SMEs accounting standard. And this amendment is about international tax reform published by the OECD. You may recall that last month, the IASB decided to develop narrow scope amendments to the IFRS for SME standard based on the finalized amendments to IAS 12 income taxes related to the OECD's Pillar 2 model rules. We discussed the proposed amendments at a special supplementary meeting in May. Andreas, would you like to take us through the IASB's discussion on this project?
Happy to, Neely. But before I explain the proposed amendments, let me reiterate what you've said. This is the first time we've proposed amendments outside the IFRS for SME standards review process, and we believe the circumstances are unique and do not anticipate making future urgent amendments to the standard. To the point, similar to the issued amendments to IAS 12, we decided to provide a temporary and mandatory exception to the requirements in the income tax section of the IFRS for SME standard. Consequently, eligible small and medium-sized companies, including first-time adopters of the IFRS for SME standard, will neither recognize nor disclose information about deferred tax assets and liabilities related to the Pillar 2 model rules. We also propose to clarify that other events in the disclosure objectives for income tax includes enacted or substantively enacted Pillar 2 legislation. We expect to publish the exposure draft on the proposed amendments in early June with a 45-day comment period until 17th July in 2023.
Thanks, Andreas. Let's move on to our standard setting projects, and let's start with primary financial statements. We started the discussion with the proposal on the classification of income and expenses from associates and joint ventures accounted for using the equity method. As some of our listeners may recall, the IASB decided to add this topic to the redeliberations plan in January in response to the feedback it received during targeted outreach last year. This month, the IASB decided to confirm its decision to require a company to classify the income and expenses from associates and joint ventures accounted for using the equity method in the investing category in the statement of profit or loss. Andreas, could you elaborate more on that?
Sure. I want to start by acknowledging the concerns raised by stakeholders in specific jurisdictions and industries. The IASB's decisions may result in a change in practice for some stakeholders and a classification outcome that some do not view as ideal, and we acknowledge that. We've tried to address these concerns from stakeholders in a balanced way and provide some tools to mitigate the concerns. So what's the proposal about? The IASB's proposal to classify income and expenses from associates and joint ventures accounted for using the equity method outside of operating profit has generally been supported by users since the start of the project. Users have explained to us that they analyze associates and joint ventures accounted for using the equity method separately from the company's operations. This does not mean that users think that their result is not important to a company's operations. It is important. However, users explained that they use different methodology to analyze them because, firstly, investments accounted for using the equity method do not have any revenue contribution and have a distorting effect on operating profit margins of a company. Secondly, companies do not control associates and joint ventures. And thirdly, share of profit or loss of associates and joint ventures accounted for using the equity method is a post-tax and post-financing amount. Classifying them outside of operating profit gives users a consistent starting point for their analysis. So that's really the reasoning behind it. Stakeholders in the insurance industry explained that they have associates and joint ventures accounted for using the equity method that are directly or indirectly linked to insurance contracts or held for prudential purposes to meet solvency requirements. These stakeholders explained that investments in these associates and joint ventures are part of investment income and net financial results, which is a key operating performance metric of an insurance company. We acknowledge the conceptual basis for these concerns. However, there is diversity in investments and associates and joint ventures in the insurance industry. So defining the scope of associates and joint ventures for which income and expenses could be classified in the operating category is likely to be as difficult as drawing a line between integral and non-integral associates and joint ventures, which the IASB decided not to proceed with given the feedback from stakeholders. Based on our research and outreach, we acknowledge that the issue may be material for some insurance companies, but is not pervasive across the global insurance industry. However, we've considered other ways to address the concerns. Nili, why don't you tell us about the tools the IASB will provide to help to mitigate the concerns?
Sure, Andreas. So previously, the IASB decided that a company can present an additional subtotal of operating profit and income and expenses from investments accounted for using the equity method. This subtotal would not meet the definition of a management performance measure if a company uses it in its public communications. So what that means is that a company would not need to provide the additional disclosures that are otherwise required for management performance measures. In addition, some companies can elect to measure associates and joint ventures at fair value through profit or loss. A company applies the selection on initial recognition of the associate or joint venture. This month, the IASB decided to provide transition requirements that will permit companies to apply the election when they first apply the accounting standard coming from this primary financial statements project. This can help mitigate concerns because income and expenses from investments in associates and joint ventures measured at fair value through profit or loss would be classified in the operating category when investing is the main business activity of a company. So, for example, an insurance company that uses this election would include these income and expenses in the operating category, generally in net financial results.
Thanks, Nelly. Another topic we discussed this month was issues related to management performance measures and IFRS 8 operating segments. I will highlight only two of the decisions. So firstly, the IASB decided to clarify that management performance measures reflect management's views of the performance of a company as a whole. Amounts for each individual segment would not typically meet the definition of management performance measures. And secondly, we confirmed the proposal that the company may disclose information about management performance measures in a note that also includes information about its operating segments when one or more of the company's management performance measures are the same as part of the operating segment information, so long as all information required to be disclosed for all management performance measures is included in that note.
Thanks, Andreas. I now will move on to the project Subsidiaries Without Public Accountability Disclosures. As a reminder to our listeners, this project is looking at how to simplify the preparation of subsidiary financial statements by permitting subsidiaries to apply IFRS accounting standards with reduced disclosure requirements. So what we're looking at here are subsidiaries that are consolidated into group accounts that apply full IFRS. But for the subsidiaries in their standalone accounts, if they do not have public accountability, this standard would enable them to apply the full recognition and measurement requirements in full IFRS, but with reduced disclosures. So this month, we continued redeliberating the proposals in the exposure draft of the project. And let me give you some of the tentative decisions that the IASB made. First, the IASB completed the discussion of the feedback on each proposed disclosure requirement in the exposure draft and decided to revise some of them. I won't go through all of the details, but please do have a look at the specific amendments in the IASB update and in the paper on our website. Secondly, the IASB decided it will proceed with its proposal to require disclosure requirements specified in a new or amended IFRS accounting standard about the company's transition to a new or amended IFRS accounting standard to remain applicable to eligible subsidiaries. And finally, disclosure requirements in amendments to IFRS accounting standards that have been issued or will be issued since the exposure draft for this project was published will apply to eligible subsidiaries until the IASB issues an amendment to the new standard. So, Andreas, can I hand things over to you now to talk about dynamic risk management?
Oh, absolutely. One of my favorite projects, Nilly. During the IASB's ongoing informal outreach on the dynamic risk management or DRM model, we have heard that providing illustrations through a series of more complex and realistic scenarios, including accounting implications of such complexities, would help their understanding of the current DRM model and support their analysis of its requirements. So based on this feedback, in this month's meeting, the team provided an illustration of the designation and application of the DRM model through a series of scenarios, with each scenario adding a level of complexity to the previous one in a comprehensive deck of slides. The board appreciated the clarity and comprehensiveness of the illustrative examples, and we thought they would be excellent to share with various stakeholder groups. We also provided some initial ideas on how to advance in the project. And our stakeholders can have a look at the slide deck of illustrative examples on our website. Another project we discussed this month was business combinations, disclosures, goodwill, and impairment, or BCDGI, as we call it. I will leave that one for you, Nilly.
Thanks, Andreas. Yeah, I still have trouble saying BCDGI, but this discussion focused on improving the impairment test of cash-generating units containing goodwill that's in IAS 36. First, the board considered whether it is feasible to design a different impairment test that is significantly more effective than the impairment test in IAS 36 at a reasonable cost. Based on the evidence that's been gathered and consideration of the alternatives, the board decided that this is not feasible. The IASB also decided not to change the existing requirement for an annual impairment test. This is actually a change from the board's preliminary view in its 2020 discussion paper and is based on consideration of the evidence that it had analyzed and stakeholder feedback. And lastly, the staff presented feedback on other possible improvements to the impairment test. The board did not make any decisions in May, and we'll discuss this topic again at a future meeting.
Thanks, Nilly, and I will leave it to you to practice BCDGI.
It shouldn't be that hard.
Indeed, no. The last project I would like to highlight is our management commentary project. Our listeners will recall that in response to our exposure draft in May 2021, many stakeholders called for the IASB to advance this project in collaboration with the ISSB. The ISSB is now conducting their consultation on agenda priorities, including a question about a project on integration in reporting and where that project should be undertaken with the IASB and build on the management commentary project and the integrated reporting framework. We encourage you to provide feedback to those questions. Both boards will consider the feedback on the ISSB consultation later this year. The IASB has effectively put its decision-making on the management commentary project on hold until additional feedback about the possible path forward for this project becomes available, in particular through the ISSB's consultation. Nonetheless, the staff continue to perform research and analysis in the background. In May, the team illustrated the similarities and differences between the integrated reporting framework and the exposure draft on management commentary, which was a joint piece of work conducted in the integrated reporting team, and they provided feedback from two of our advisory bodies on the analysis and approach to future alignment between those documents. This work is also consistent with a commitment that Emmanuel Faber, chair of the IASSB, and I made last year to consider opportunities to address similarities and differences between the management commentary exposure draft and the integrated reporting framework. This was an education session, so no decisions were made. And further details are available in the deck of slides on our website and in feedback summaries.
Thanks, Andreas. So that concludes our May discussions. But before we wrap up, Andreas, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I think just to mention that this month, the IASB approved a 120-day comment period for the exposure draft financial instruments with characteristics of equity, or FICE for short. We gave the staff permission to start the drafting of the exposure draft, which we are looking to publish in Q4 this year. Further, the staff provided the board with its recommendations on which FICE disclosures proposals to reduce for purposes of the subsidiaries without public accountability project. The board was largely in agreement with the proposal, but asked for a couple of changes to be made. The board also approved a common period of 120 days for the request for information on the post-implementation review of IFRS 15, revenue from contracts with customers, which we expect to publish at the end of June. And finally, the IASB decided to add two further amendments in the next annual improvements to IFRS accounting standard cycle. We expect to publish an exposure draft, including those and other proposed amendments in September this year, with a 90-day comment period. So stay tuned.
Thanks, Andreas. So lots of publications coming out in the next few months. That is all for this month's podcast. You can catch up on previous episodes of this and the Interpretation Committee podcast on our website, as well as on our YouTube channel and Spotify. For the latest developments, make sure to subscribe to our website. And if you like this podcast, please do take some time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. Thank you very much for joining us, and please stay tuned again next month for an update on the June IASB meeting. Thank you.